Hi, the program is Conversation. I'm Jim Tudor. This edition airs Thursday, October the 17th at noon, and repeats the following Saturday the 19th at 7:30 p.m. My guest is formerly executive editor, also she wore several hats over the years, senior editor, writer, freelance writer for Cincinnati Magazine, Linda Vaccarello. Good afternoon, good evening, whenever you're listening.
Hi, Jim.
Good to have you on the program. I used to be broadcast coordinator at Radio Reading Services, and one of my favorite listens was Donna Shapley reading Cincinnati Magazine, which she always read the feature articles. Airs, by the way, for you listening, Mondays at 12:30 p.m. and repeats Saturdays at 8 p.m. And it's Cincinnati Magazine is listed in our program guide as readings from featured articles, including food, culture, sports, and style. Does that sum up Cincinnati Magazine for you?
Well, that's a lot of what Cincinnati Magazine covers, yeah.
When you joined the magazine, how was it doing? Was it on sound financial footing? Or?
Yeah, it was. I joined the magazine and I started freelancing for the magazine in 1983. I'd only lived in Cincinnati at that point about 3 years. And I joined the staff full-time in 1986. And it was a vibrant publication then.
86, that would be 19 years after it started publishing.
Yeah,
first
right.
Issue was October 67, which was just 2 or 3 months after WEBN came on the air,
yeah.
Which I worked at for a few years in the 70s and late 60s. No, it was the 70s into early 80s. But 67 must have been a good year for new new businesses.
Well, I think that was probably because there was this whole bunch of baby boomers who were, you know, just becoming adults, and so WEBN was there to play their music, and then
our music, come on.
Well, right, our music. And then also in the late 60s, cities were going through a lot of changes.
Yes.
It was, you know, we were building Riverfront Stadium. There were lots of things, expansion going on. And so city magazines kind of developed in a number of cities to be the, you know, the vehicle by which the story of the new city was being told.
Mm-hmm. Well, it started out in, if my assessment is correct of the first issue, it was more like a city beat in the beginning. It would have departments featured, it would say sports or nightclubs or whatever, and they made it, they changed it to a more of a broad view of those scenes, didn't they?
Well, it was begun, actually, by the Chamber of Commerce.
Oh, really?
Its first few years, it was created and published by the Chamber of Commerce. Those first few issues in the late 60s took on some, there were some heavy stories that they took on. They wrote about the aftermath of the riots.
Oh.
And I remember looking, of course, I wasn't around then, but there was a wonderful, it was the late 60s were the time when Maude Adams was being kind of reborn by,
yes,
a whole generation of young people discovering, mm-hmm, it. And there was a photo essay about Maude Adams and what was going on there. And in 1980, the owners of Columbus Monthly tried to start a city magazine in Cincinnati and discovered that they had failed. So with the great American attitude of if you can't beat them, buy them, they bought Cincinnati Magazine and took over publication of the magazine. And after that, it became, it did kind of take to the, you know, departments about sports, mm-hmm, and politics and, mm-hmm, and features about kind of news-oriented features.
But where the features were labeled more generally in the early issues, they would get more specific in their titles, like Bengals not looking too good this week in their first game. You know, they spotlighted better what you might be reading in the article.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
At least that's the way I see
as
it.
As the way it looked to you? Okay, I can understand that.
Mm-hmm. Now, back in the 60s, you weren't in Cincinnati, were you?
No, I didn't move here until 1980, about the time that some changes were happening at the magazine.
Where were you? Where did you grow up?
I'm from northeastern Ohio.
Okay. Well, I won't hold that against you.
I grew up in a rural area about 30 miles east of Cleveland and went to college there and did graduate work at Kent State. And my background is in theater. And I moved down here with a graduate degree in arts administration. And at the time that I moved down here, there weren't a lot of opportunities, so I started writing. Mm-hmm. And that's how I ended up writing for Cincinnati Magazine.
Now, when the Columbus people bought out Cincinnati Magazine, did they, you know, fire the whole staff and start over? Did they try to reinvent the wheel? Or?
Well, I wasn't around then, so I'm not sure how it worked. But they did hire Laura Pulfer, who was a writer at the Cincinnati Post, to be editor and publisher.
Uh-huh.
And she brought in a younger staff, I believe, and kind of created a more lively look at the city and its entertainment and its culture.
Terrific. And then you started doing freelance.
Yeah.
Do you remember the first?
Yeah, I do remember. The first story I wrote was just a small item about Katie Lauer, folk singer Katie Lauer, appearing on a Prairie Home Companion and how there were a number of folk musicians who had appeared on the early broadcasts of the Prairie Home Companion when it became a national publication.
Katie Lauer, who for years was with the Appalachian Grass.
Right, right.
I enjoyed seeing them numerous times.
So that's the first story that I wrote.
And she later went into radio for a while at the old WNKU.
She was on WNKU for a number of years.
A very unique personality.
And then she wrote for Cincinnati for a while as a freelancer. And I didn't know that. Yeah, I was her editor then.
Okay. Did she write always about music? Or?
No, she wrote about her life in Cincinnati and wrote a lot about kind of the culture of Cincinnati as she experienced it. And she brought a really interesting sensibility to the magazine.
You're telling me she had Shakespearean? Did I hear Shakespearean in your last statement?
No, I just said that she brought a real interesting sensibility to the magazine.
I don't know where I heard Shakespearean, but I just couldn't picture Katie Lauer as Shakespearean, so that's why I called you on it. So what does an executive editor do that's different from a senior editor?
Well, I was made executive editor when I'd been there a really long time, but I helped shape some of the issues, and I assigned and edited a lot of the stories. I wasn't the editor in chief, but I think I had a hand in shaping the magazine and in the last few years I was there before I retired.
Mm-hmm. You probably met some interesting people.
Yeah, at
Cincinnati Magazine. Do you have any favorites?
Well, I had the opportunity to interview Jerry Springer a number of times. In fact, when he was considering a run for Senate,
right.
One summer, I followed him on the campaign trail, and
you went to Toledo.
I did. Well, actually, I did go to Toledo.
Uh-huh.
I went to Toledo and a little town called Napoleon,
where
he was speaking to small groups. And it was just fascinating to see how people responded to him, which they responded to him wonderfully, of course. And it's really hard not to have a good time when you're in an SUV with Jerry Springer driving around Northwest Ohio.
Yeah, I've met him a few times. He's quite a nice guy and very affable. You never felt like he was looking down at you. You know what I'm saying?
No, Jerry really really has a fundamental interest in people
yes,
and learning about who they are and where they're coming from.
And he has a handicapped daughter too, doesn't he?
I don't know. I really don't know about that aspect of his life.
Okay. I didn't know how well you got to know him. Other people that are on your list of memorables, fascinating. What?
Well, I got to do a telephone interview with occasionally, you know, when people were coming to town, we in advance of their appearance, we would get to do telephone interviews with them, and and so I got to, you know, do a telephone interview with Judy Collins, in which Ooh. I learned that that, you know, she does close to 300 appearances. She still sings close to 300 appearances a year, which is just extraordinary. I got to do a telephone interview with Lily Tomlin, in which she talked about her, you know, Lily Tomlin was from Kentucky. And
I didn't know that.
I'm pretty sure, I don't know if she was born in Kentucky, but was living with her family in Kentucky at one time. And then, like a lot of Appalachian families, they ended up in the Detroit area.
Mm-hmm.
And she told me about something that I'd never heard of, which was there was a bus line that would run between, you know, small towns in Kentucky and Detroit and Toledo and all of the, you know, the post-war industrial sites, but in particular Detroit, and would take, you know, Appalachian families who had moved up to Detroit to work in the automotive plants, take them back home on the weekends. There were these bus lines just dedicated to that, and that's this
wow.
little slice of history that I had never heard before.
Nor I. I hadn't heard of it either. I thought, I wonder what was the other bus company? There was Greyhound and there was Trailways. He wasn't...
No, it wasn't either Greyhound or
Trailways.
In my mind, it was something like the Bluebird Bus Company or something like that. It was one of these, you know, tiny regional bus lines that was, mm-hmm. and they still exist, not that particular one, but there's a bus line that runs just between Cincinnati and Ohio University, taking
yes.
people back and forth. There's took a bus that runs from Chinatown in Manhattan into the Midwest to take people back.
Is that right?
Yeah. So there are some really dedicated bus lines that take people back and forth to visit family.
Mm-hmm. Some of my favorites in the current Cincinnati magazine are Jay Gilbert and his Dr. No column.
Yes.
Of course, I worked with Jay at EBN for a while. I shouldn't say worked with him. We both worked at the same place. Barely, seldom saw each other because I was weakened. And my other favorite Cincinnati magazine is Greg Hand's columns.
His history column.
History,
yeah.
Yeah.
Those are both so much fun for people. I think they're fun for people who've been around here for a long time and are delighted when somebody remembers something from the past. But they're also great fun for people who are relatively new to town, who don't know about some of the traditions here. One of the things in Jay's current Dr. No column is he's writing about Fred's Place.
Yes.
Which was the downtown store where you could go and find test products from Procter & Gamble.
Seanciola's. I used to get lunch there frequently.
Yes.
my foster father worked for the, back then it was called the welfare department, and sometimes I would meet him for lunch.
Mm-hmm.
We'd walk over there. But Jay gave an address that I didn't agree with because I should talk to Jay about this, but I always thought that Seanciola's was on the southeast corner of 7th and Main, and the address he gave suggested to me that it might have been on the southwest corner. So I'll have to argue with Jay on that.
Well,
sometime.
My memory is that it was on the southeast corner too,
yeah,
but
yeah.
It may have moved. I don't know. If it was on the southwest corner it would have been where the Aronoff is.
Right. And now, he said they were closed. I know they moved up Main Street a block or two, but maybe they are gone now. I'll have to check into that.
Yeah.
But Seancioli's had good sandwiches and quite a variety of snacks. Probably the biggest selection of candy bars in downtown Cincinnati. My guest is Linda Vaccarello. And Linda, we're going to, if you don't mind, we're going to go to Donna Shapley reading just a little bit of Cincinnati Magazine. Cincinnati Magazine, of course, hosted by Donna, I think almost since the beginning of time. Her father read it for a while, and then she picked it up, and she's still reading Cincinnati Magazine. Her program airs Mondays at 12:30 p.m., repeats Saturdays at 8 p.m. on the radio that reads for the Tri-State. I wonder if they use that slogan here anymore. Anyway, here's Donna, and we'll be back in with more of our conversation in just a couple of minutes.
Next in Front Lines, we turn to theater and Fact Check. Cincinnati Playhouse in the Parks, latest direct from Broadway production, focuses on one central idea, truth. The lifespan of a fact follows Jim Fingle, an overzealous magazine intern fact-checking author, John DeGatta's article on a teen's suicide in Las Vegas. It's based on real events, which Playhouse artistic director Blake Robeson says makes the show more potent. As Americans, we're all in the conversation about the nature of news, what's real, what's fake, and what liberties the writer has taken. As Fingal goes to extraordinary lengths to corral DeGatta's exaggerations, audiences get a look at how fact-checking mostly works. We had Patrick Murphy, our fact checker, compare his experiences to the show's. Jim Fingal, an intern, has 5 days to fact check a 15-page article and assembles 130 pages of fact checking changes. Patrick Murphy, interns generally don't check feature articles. I do, and 3 pages of changes would be a stretch. Jim Fingal uses C++, Python, and Lisp computer coding languages to create custom searches and automated batch applications. Patrick Murphy uses quotation marks around names and dates in Google searches, calls the source. Jim Fingal flies to Las Vegas to check the color of a brick building. Patrick Murphy, have you heard of Google Maps? Jim Fingal, to check, the wind was blowing hard but did not come into my house, goes to the author's house and huffs and puffs like the big bad wolf. Patrick Murphy asks local blues guitarist Dudley Taft Jr. to measure his beard length. It was 9.5 inches instead of 8, by the way. Jim Fingal believes his near obsessive attention to details helps resist a growing skepticism in journalism. Patrick Murphy, same. The lifespan of a fact, Playhouse in the Park, Mount Adams, October 19th through November 16th. Next, we turn to Frontline's Pop Life. Rivertown Sound, celebrating Cincinnati's musical heritage through a new illustrated set of trading cards by Stuart Lindell. Many of Cincinnati's most influential musicians owe their careers to chance encounters. So it's fitting that serendipity also played a role in the creation of Shake It Records, inaugural deck of Cincinnati musical legends, produced in conjunction with Artworks, a set of 36 cards featuring illustrated portraits and bios celebrating those very same people. For more than a decade, Darren Blaze, co-owner of Shake It Records, looked at comic book artist Robert Crumb's Heroes of Blues, Jazz, and Country trading cards and thought Cincinnati musicians deserved their share of the limelight. When Blaze began working with comic artist Justin Green, they realized they shared a common interest in R. Crumb's work and eventually took the Musical Legends project from idea to reality. Look out for the cards and some of their source materials, old photographs, postcards, and songbooks on view at the Public Library of Cincinnati and Hamilton County's downtown branch now through the end of the year. Buy the cards at Shake It, where you can also find albums from the artists who shaped the Queen City.
The program is Conversation. I'm Jim Tudor, and my guest this month is Linda Vaccarello. Formerly with Cincinnati Magazine, wore a variety of hats there, and she is retired now, but we're having a fun conversation about our city.
It's great to be here. I love talking about Cincinnati Magazine and about how it has been shaped by the city. I notice over the years the stories that the magazine has pursued and some of the things that's written about have been, you know, have morphed as the city has changed. For example, back in the late 80s and early 90s, mm-hmm. we used to write about a lot of media personalities.
Ah.
TV and radio personalities, and
I missed out on my 15 minutes.
Well, and the magazine simply doesn't do that as often, and I think in part because, for example, you know, this was such an important radio town, the personalities on the radio are not quite, everybody doesn't listen to the same stuff any longer, so everybody doesn't know who...
Isn't that true?
...the radio voices are, yeah. So you can't kind of say, oh, we're going to write about so-and-so, and everybody knows who so-and-so is because yeah. they listen to him in the morning.
With the exception of maybe WLW and their mm-hmm. personalities.
Yeah.
Or sports announcers, because even people who might not listen to WLW because of political differences are probably going to sure. tune in a ball game.
Yeah, yeah.
Baseball, football, basketball,
yeah.
college.
Yeah, so there's some aspects of it are more siloed. But,
sure.
You know, the other thing that's really different about when I, you know, the coverage of the magazine when I joined it in the mid-1980s to today is that everybody got their information about restaurants from the City Magazine and from the newspaper. And today, because of social media, there are a whole lot more places to get information about
yes.
restaurants and dining and mm-hmm. and to read reviews of restaurants. And Cincinnati Magazine, as you can see, still writes restaurant reviews.
Yes.
But
They try to specialize from month to month in a particular type of restaurant.
Right.
Though,
and we'll do, but one of the things that has changed is that even though people don't rely on the newspaper or a magazine for, you know, their only restaurant reviews, people have become much more sophisticated about food.
Mm-hmm.
So Cincinnati Magazine can do a long story devoted to discussing all of the Korean restaurants in town because
yes.
there's more than one and mm-hmm. people are sophisticated about different kinds of dining. So that's been an interesting change in the way magazines have approached their content.
Mm-hmm. You anticipated my question. I have it here. How has Cincinnati Magazine changed over the years? And you anticipated me. Are there other regional magazines like Cincinnati Magazine?
Yeah.
There must be, because you mentioned Columbus earlier.
Yeah, yeah. We Cincinnati Magazine used to be owned by Columbus Monthly. In 1997, it was purchased by Emmis Communications, which is based in Indianapolis and owns a number of city magazines.
And radio stations.
And radio stations, right. And then about 2 years ago, it was produced by Our Communications, which is based in Detroit and owns Our Detroit and a number of publications like that. But probably the city magazine that most people know about is New York Magazine, which has a national readership. But there's a Cleveland Magazine. Mm-hmm. There's Texas Monthly, which covers the whole state.
I'm going to editorialize here for a minute. And if I, get on my soapbox too long, knock me down. But you would hope and wish that Cincinnati Magazine was locally owned. Too much of business is not local anymore, whether it's radio, whether it's our gas and electric, or
banks.
Our banks, the Cincinnati Magazine. It's a bad thing that's going on in our economy right now, in my opinion.
Well,
I'll get down now.
It's okay, and certainly there's a lot to be said for local ownership. On the other hand, publishing is there are cost savings to being owning 5 magazines and being able to purchase paper and ink by the ton. And that's the sort of thing, for example, when we were owned by Emmis Communications. Emmis owned Cincinnati Magazine, they owned Indianapolis Monthly, they owned Texas Monthly, Orange Coast, Atlanta Magazine, and being part of that group of publications, there were certain, economies of scale. We weren't controlled by that, by a publication, but mm-hmm. There were economies of scale that made things possible for us.
So they didn't dictate what they wanted in the magazine. They pretty much let you have autonomy?
Yeah, we were pretty autonomous. We mm-hmm. certainly got to take advantage of the fact that there was, a vice president who could make suggestions about things we might want to try. And there was that kind of input that we got, but we weren't controlled.
Okay, we only have a few minutes left. Is there something that I haven't covered that you would like to talk about in regards to the magazine or to your connection with Cincinnati?
Well, I just wanted to say that I think city magazines have a real value in a city, whether it's Cincinnati or Indianapolis or Cleveland. They are something that people can look to get a deeper understanding of what's going on in their community. And I just feel like, there are lots of sources of information that people can turn to. And I hope that city magazines stay on your reading list because, they have a lot to offer.
Oh, I'm sure they will here at Radio Reading Services. I want to repeat that Donna Shapley has been hosting Cincinnati Magazine for years, and you can hear it on Radio Reading Services Monday afternoons at 12:30 p.m. and repeats Saturday evenings at 8 p.m. It occurred to me while I was sitting here that one thing I didn't talk to you about was the review of real estate that is in Cincinnati Magazine. Do they look for special houses, or how do they determine?
They look for interesting houses that people might be curious about.
Was that done while you were editor?
In different forms, I think we've always tried to give our readers the chance to, someone refers to it as real estate porn, to give our readers a chance to...
I'll never look at that column the same.
To kind of get inside a residence that they might be curious about.
Real estate porn. What? Linda, thank you. Thank you for being here.
It's great to be here.
Appearing on Conversation. It's been a pleasure. And all of you, thank you for listening. The program is Conversation on Radio Reading Services of Greater Cincinnati. I'm Jim Tudor. See you next month.